From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, climate change, missed opportunities to halt or at least slow it down, and where we are now in the Trump era. We talk with Nathaniel Rich, author of the new book Losing Earth, about the progress we could have made in the 80s just before the oil industry started funding climate skeptics and deniers, and before the Republican Party moved further to the right than the industry.
Exxon publicly today doesn't deny climate change, but you have a party that does.
He thinks young people today are reframing the issue in a stark, direct, personal way.
They're saying that failure to act is harming us, is killing us, that you elders who are failing to act are stealing our future away from us.
And Ken Tucker reviews the new album by 17-year-old singer-songwriter Billie Eilish. As we deal with more extreme weather around the world and hear more dire reports about the future impact of climate change, you have to wonder, why didn't we succeed in taking preventive measures sooner, before things had progressed? That's one of the key questions my guest Nathaniel Rich tries to answer in his new book, Losing Earth, A Recent History. It's an expanded version of his report that the New York Times Magazine devoted an entire issue to last August. He focuses on the period from 1979 to 89, a period he describes as a time before the fossil fuel industry funded scientists to create doubt about the science of climate change, and before the Republican Party adopted climate denialism as a central tenet. He focuses on the scientists, activists, and political leaders who pushed for measures to limit carbon emissions, and the political and corporate leaders who blocked them. We're also going to talk about where we are now, with a president who doubts the science and a growing movement of young people insisting on action reversing the path we're on. Nathaniel Rich, welcome to Fresh Air. How much worse has the climate change problem gotten since your book ends in 1989?
More carbon dioxide has been emitted into the atmosphere since the final page of the book, basically, since the end of 1989. Than in the history of civilization preceding it. So it's gotten a lot worse. Obviously, the political situation's gotten a lot worse as well. It's become a starkly partisan issue. I don't have to tell anyone that. And it seems like we are much further from a solution than we were 30 years ago.
You write that now long-term disaster is the best-case scenario. Would you explain that?
Yeah, well, a certain amount of warming is baked in, and that's, referring to some of the projections about 1.5 or 2 degrees Celsius warming above historical means. And there's all kinds of horrific scenarios that come with that. Of course, that's not nearly as bad as, 3 degrees or 4 degrees or 5 degrees warming. But even when we talk about it in those terms, in sort of half degrees or full degrees warming, it's almost euphemistic because there's such dramatic differences even between, 2 degrees and 2.1 degrees or 2.1 degrees and 2.2 degrees. And I think one of the lies, sort of convenient dishonesties we have about the issue, one of the more benign ones, I guess, is that we think of it almost like in Hollywood terms, like either we're going to win this thing or we're going to suffer a crushing defeat. But of course, there's a huge range of outcomes in between. And at this point, yeah, where we're at, ranging from the not very good to the apocalyptic, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't try to better our situation as much as possible.
Is there a moment when you think we came really close to seriously cutting back on the carbon emissions that are responsible for climate change during the period that you write about, 79 to 89?
Absolutely. From 79 to 89, there are a series of efforts, escalating efforts, to first bring the issue to the attention of the powers that be, people at the highest levels of the federal government, and then to bring it to the public, to generate public concern. And finally, in the middle of the decade, a solution materializes, which is a global treaty to reduce emissions that would be binding. And it's modeled after the Ozone Treaty that's then in process. And by the end of the decade, we've reached the point of high-level diplomatic meetings to negotiate this binding global treaty. And we get to the precipice of an agreement on the framework of this treaty. And at the very last second, the U.S. pulls out, which is the story I tell in the book. And so I think that, at least on paper, that's the closest we've come. I think you could have a reasonable, you know, debate about whether or not if the U.S. did sign the treaty, they would have lived up. We would have lived up to the terms of it, whether other countries would have lived up to the terms of it, even if it was binding. And that's a more, you know, complicated conversation to have. I think at the very least, we'd be a lot further ahead than we are now. That seems indisputable.
So what year did the U.S. pull out of this treaty? Who was the president and why did we pull out?
So it's 1989. The president is George H.W. Bush. And the previous summer, James Hansen, a NASA scientist who had become essentially the face of climate science, gave a testimony before Congress in which he said, global warming is here. It's no longer a theory. We're seeing evidence of warming in global temperatures. It was the hottest summer in American history at the time. And the story became a major public national story. And to the point that even George Bush on the campaign stump gave speeches about it, was making promises that as president, he would solve the problem, then called the greenhouse effect as well. And he said, you know, those who think we can't solve the greenhouse effect haven't heard about the White House effect. And when I'm in the White House, you know, we'll solve it. And he gets to the White House. James Baker, who's the new Secretary of State, in his first major speech at the State Department, he invites the IPCC, the international organization under the auspices of the United Nations that's begins drafting a treaty. They have one of their first meetings at the State Department, and he endorses this program. And over the course of the year, you get to a meeting in Noordwijk in the Netherlands, a kind of coastal town on the North Sea. That's the first high-level diplomatic meeting of environmental ministers from all over the world, 65 countries or so come there. And there's a general sense that everyone's going to sign essentially a letter of intent that they will pursue a binding treaty to reduce global emissions. At that meeting, the U.S. pulls out. And the reason, at least the narrow political reason for that, is that over the course of that year, there had been a huge fight within the administration between William Riley, the head of Bush's EPA, and John Sununu, his chief of staff. And Sununu was highly skeptical of the science and suspicious of the motives of this treaty. And he was ultimately more powerful and won the argument, essentially, and was able to force the U.S. delegation to not accept anything that was binding. And at that point, the treaty became watered down.
Do you think that some of these treaties are almost like masquerades where countries show up and they look really great, like, we're going to do it, we're going to sign it, and then at the last minute you pull out? Like, it's almost like a game of chicken, like nobody really wants to do it, but everybody's waiting for somebody else to pull out, that no one really has the political will to make the sacrifices that need to be made.
Yeah, that's John Sununu's argument, basically. I spoke to him at length for the book, and he said, listen, I mean, he's totally unapologetic about his role in this. And I said, you know, do you claim responsibility for thwarting any chance of a solution on this? And he said, I wish I could. But in fact, I felt that we were the only honest brokers at the table and that the other countries weren't serious, that even though it was, you know, a, quote, binding agreement, essentially what's the country going to do if someone doesn't hit their targets? Are they going to bomb them? You know, are they going to have economic sanctions? I mean, of course not. And in fact, the leader of the delegation, Alan Bromley, who was Bush's science advisor and was kind of Sununu's man in Noordwijk. He wrote a memoir in which he essentially said the same thing, that he said that in conversations with other delegates, other environmental ministers at Noordwijk, he asked them, you know, how are you going to hit these targets? Do you have plans, you know, to reduce emissions by 20% or whatever by a certain year? And they would say, a couple of them told him, well, no, but it's just a piece of paper and you know, no one's going to send us to jail. And so I think, yes, it's certain, I think you have to take seriously that kind of cynical view. And I think you can't really take seriously Sununu's scientific opinions on this matter, but I think you can take seriously his skepticism about the power of these treaties.
You said in an interview that you spent an enormous amount of time researching the oil industry and their efforts in blocking the efforts to curb carbon emissions. And you also said that it actually plays a very little part in your book. You didn't use much of your research. So why is that?
The industry has been following this issue for a long time. You know, there are studies from Exxon or even Humble Oil, the predecessor to Exxon, going back into the mid-1950s. And even then, those studies were not about whether or not this was happening. It was really, the question was how much of the added CO2 in the atmosphere was because of Exxon, basically, because of the fossil fuel industry. And they continued to monitor this over the decades. There were, you know, occasional sort of CO2 working groups, study groups. This was going on also at the American Petroleum Institute, the big trade group for the oil and gas industry, and at some of the other companies. And those efforts continued through the 80s, but it was never high. During that decade, obviously things have changed quite dramatically, but during that decade, it was never a high priority. And I spoke with a lot of people who worked in the industry during that time and people at the highest levels of API, and they really weren't concerned about it, in part because there was no serious efforts in D.C. to pass you know, laws or have policies to reduce emissions. And it wasn't really until James Hansen, the NASA scientist, spoke before Congress in 88 and generated a huge huge national headlines that they started to worry. And the story of how they began to mobilize this multi-decadal effort to sow propaganda, disinformation, to buy off politicians and scientists, and ultimately to convert an entire political party to denialism, is the seeds of that you see emerging in the weeks and months after the Hansen hearing. But before that, it was really on the back burner.
So let's talk about how the oil industry's lobbying efforts changed at the end of the 80s, where your book ends. You write about how the American Petroleum Institute started funding a lobbying group. They formed the lobbying organization, the Global Climate Coalition. And what did this lobbying group do to mobilize public opinion to be skeptical of climate science?
Yeah, it's sort of a remarkable turn of events in that after Hansen's hearing, there are these high-level conversations at the American Petroleum Institute and at Exxon about essentially what do we do about this. It seems clear that regulation is coming. You know, George Bush is talking about it and so on. And they essentially reach the same conclusions, Exxon and API. They say, we need to be an active participant in any kind of policy discussion. We need to burnish our credentials as you know, scientific experts on the subject, so we have credibility in it. We need to make sure that the science, that the policy doesn't extend beyond what the science says. Emphasize uncertainty where it exists. That would become, you know, crucial later on. And then, perhaps most important, don't accept any policy that will hurt the bottom line. That's the beginning of it. And then, as almost an afterthought at the time, API through its press office, which is coordinating the press for this industry group, Global Climate Coalition, starts to reach out to a couple of scientists who are friendly with the industry, who have expressed some doubt about either ozone or CO2, and they start encouraging them to speak to the press. Sometimes that encouragement takes the form of payouts. The head of the API program told me they gave $2,000 to a scientist whenever he wrote an op-ed for a national publication. And that is almost an afterthought at the time. It's pretty low on the totem pole of what they're doing. They're also meeting with congressmen and so on. But it pays enormous dividends because all of a sudden, national news publications start quoting these scientists. It's really a handful of people, four or five people, over and over again. And an issue that to this point has been a story about, you know, fear of what's going to happen, all of a sudden has two sides. And of course, that's like catnip for the journalists. And all of a sudden, you have a number of pieces that start to appear that say maybe there's not scientific consensus about this problem.
Right. By generating controversy around climate change, where it sounds like before there weren't people denying it. There were people saying, based on your research, there were people saying, well, we don't really know for sure how bad things are going to be. Do we really want to risk the economy over science that's not kind of nailed down yet? We don't know what the consequences will be or when they'll be exactly. So let's kind of keep the status quo as long as we can. So it goes from that to like, oh, the whole notion of climate change is controversial. There's two sides. So is that like one of the innovations of the late 80s, making it like controversial with two sides and one of the sides saying, this science really might not be true at all?
Yeah, exactly. And it starts almost tentatively. It starts with saying, well, it's not as certain as we think, as people say it, as James Hansen says it is. There's problems with the climate models, the computer models that you know, Hansen uses. And then it goes into, we really don't know what the regional effects will be. And it grows and grows. It's almost like they're encouraged by their success and they become more and more brazen. And then ultimately you get, after a number of years into the 90s, you get into this bizarro universe where all of a sudden they're questioning the basic fundamental science itself. And of course that science goes back not to just 1979, but to the late 19th century. About, you know, what's the effect of pumping a bunch of CO2 into the atmosphere and what warming will that cause? And we've entered this weird funhouse realm where now, if you jump ahead to the present day, you have a political party, the only major political party in the world, that endorses a position that's essentially to the right even of what the industry now says in their public statements, you know. Exxon publicly today doesn't deny climate change, but you have a party that does. And so it's I think it's something that future historians will spend a lot of time piecing out, is how this sort of little lie grew into a big lie and overwhelmed our politics.
Do you think it's fair to say that the fossil fuel industry invented the idea of climate denial?
Yeah. I think that's fair to say.
Okay. This is interesting. You say that the industry, the fossil fuel industry, saw an upside to the warming trends of climate change. What was the upside for them?
Oh, well, there are a few. I mean, drilling in the Arctic is one of them, which you see starting to happen now.
Drilling in the Arctic because of the permafrost melting?
Because the ice melting, and so that opens up shipping passages, and you can get to more oil. And of course, they were studying that back in the 80s as well, licking their chops. But also one of the early findings from API was that in a warmer world, you'd need more energy, essentially more air conditioning. And that would you know, further industry profits.
My guest is Nathaniel Rich, author of the new book Losing Earth, A Recent History. We'll talk more about climate change and what stood in the way of taking action to stop or slow it, and how young activists today are redefining the issue after we take a short break. We'll also hear Ken Tucker's review of Billie Eilish's debut album. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Mayo Clinic. When you are searching for answers that no one else has been able to find, when the most important person in your life needs the right diagnosis, when you are searching for options, solutions, and hope, you know where to go. Mayo Clinic. Find out more at mayoclinic.org/answers.
Let's get back to my interview with Nathaniel Rich, author of the new book Losing Earth, A Recent History. It's about climate change and why we didn't take action sooner to stop or at least slow it. Rich examines the period from 1979 to 1989, a period he describes as a time before the fossil fuel industry funded scientists to create doubt about the science of climate change, and before the Republican Party adopted climate denialism as a central tenet. He focuses on the scientists, activists, and political leaders who pushed for measures to limit carbon emissions, and the political and corporate leaders who blocked them. So we were just talking about the oil industry's role in obstructing movement forward on stopping climate change. Politicians played a strong role in this, too. One of the centerpieces of your book is the NASA scientist James Hansen testifying before Congress about carbon emissions, climate change, and what we're in store for if we don't move forward. And his testimony, you can say it was suppressed, you could say it was censored, I don't know what word you want to use, but the H.W. Bush administration tried to stop him from saying what he planned on saying. Tell us who tried to do it and how.
Yeah, this is something that had not been known. And one of the things I most wanted to figure out was that after Hansen testifies in 1988, of course, and he's been testifying all decade, but in 88 he gets this huge amount of attention. And in 1989, he's due to go back. And this is right as negotiations are really getting started on a global treaty. And John Sununu is fighting this. And his testimony comes back not only with deletions, but also with absurd new language, essentially to the effect that no regulatory policy should be introduced if it at all forces the U.S. to suffer economically. Of course, nothing a scientist would say in any context, and he's outraged, understandably. And he takes this testimony to Al Gore, who's then the senator and leading the hearing. And Gore calls the New York Times, and they run a huge story about it. And it becomes a major scandal. And in fact, it generates more support for climate policy than Hansen could have done by himself. And it had been unknown, who was responsible for that at the time. The White House claimed it was some bureaucrat five levels down from the top. I asked John Sununu if he knew anything about it, and he said, yeah, I did. I was responsible for it, that he told Richard Darman, the head of the OMB at the time, to censor it. He didn't think that Hansen's claims had merit, and he tried to stop it.
How much of a scientist was John Sununu?
He considered himself a scientist. He considered himself, he called himself.
On what grounds?
An old engineer. I mean, on fairly legitimate grounds. He got a PhD, in, I believe, in fluid engineering. And he had taught. And he even taught a class. He taught at MIT, even taught a class about science and public policy. And so he fashioned himself, an expert and smarter than any of the scientists whose work he was reviewing. And because he had done some computer modeling, although of a very different sort, as a PhD student, he felt that that gave him the authority to say that Hansen's computer modeling about climate, extremely sophisticated computer programs that he was running, were inaccurate and bad. And that was sort of the foundation of his argument of why, you know, this climate science stuff was made up.
So let's jump to where we are today. Let's start with President Trump and his administration. Do you consider President Trump a climate skeptic or a climate denier?
It almost seems to sort of confer too much dignity to give him either of those terms. I mean, denier, certainly a denier. But, you know, that's almost like we're engaging now in a kind of fantasy realm that is to say even that he's a denier suggests that he's actually sort of thinks about it and has weighed the science. And I don't think that's what we're really talking about when it comes to the president.
But there are people in his administration, I think, who are pretty hardcore skeptics or deniers. Who are some of those people?
Oh, gee. Yeah. Well, I mean, Scott Pruitt now deposed, Ryan Zinke now deposed, basically Andrew Wheeler. So the, you know, Pruitt, head of EPA, replaced by Wheeler, Zinke in the interior, Myron Ebbels, sort of an old denier who's within the administration, just about every person, I think, Rick Perry, head of energy. It's the whole party. I mean, I don't think it's hard today, at least at the national level, to be a viable candidate on the right and accept scientific consensus on climate change. It's endemic, and it's at this point, I think it's constitutional. It's a central tenet of Republicanism.
So one of President Trump's first actions was to pull the United States out of the Paris Agreement on climate change. What are some of his other, what are some of the other things he's done to block any momentum forward on stopping, on limiting carbon emissions?
Oh, trying to roll back just about every, you know, policy that President Obama introduced, trying to roll back clean air standards, emissions from coal factories, mileage standards, CAFE standards they're called, you name it, all-out assault, and not just on climate, but on any kind of environmental protection, I should say. And you know, I guess the only silver lining is that with something like the Paris Accord, it's there. You know, he can withdraw, but the formal withdrawal doesn't happen for a couple of years, and even then, the treaty is voluntary to begin with. So it's more of a political statement than anything else. But rolling back emission standards is probably at the top of the list of the bad things that are going on. But I think more destructive is just this peddling of this kind of this fantasy and this essentially, I mean, it's connected to a lot of other stuff you see in the administration, a basic affront on objective reality. And you see that extends beyond the climate conversation and into, you know, the conversation we're having about news and reporting and historical fact and all the rest.
Let me reintroduce you. If you're just joining us, my guest is Nathaniel Rich, and his new book is called Losing Earth, A Recent History. We'll talk more about climate change after a break. This is Fresh Air.
We'd like to thank our sponsor who brings you this message, Discover, who alerts you if they find your Social Security number on any one of thousands of risky websites. Discover believes there are some things you just need to know. It's just another way Discover looks out for you, not just your account. And best of all, Social Security alerts are free for Discover card members. All you have to do is sign up online. Learn more at discover.com/freealerts. Limitations apply.
Hey, it's Ophira Eisenberg, host of NPR's Ask Me Another. And this month, we're celebrating women in comedy. And this week, from the Netflix series Russian Doll, we're joined by co-creator Leslie Headland and actor Greta Lee. We challenge them to not one, but two games about real nesting dolls and fashionable food trends. Listen and subscribe now.
My guest is Nathaniel Rich, author of the new book, Losing Earth, A Recent History. One of the things I know you've thought about a lot is what is the best way to motivate change at the political level and also just at the behavioral level, but what we do in our daily lives. Is it through terrifying people with apocalyptic scenarios? Like, what is the best way to motivate change? What are some of your thoughts about that?
Yeah, this has been a big debate, particularly within the activist community for a while now about, you know, it's essentially a marketing question. How do we get people to care about this problem and prioritize it? And is fear the best approach? Is hope and, you know, inspiring people? I think the trend has been towards the latter more. I feel like...
Toward hope?
Towards hope, you know, that
but
people need positive stories.
One of the books on the bestseller list now is a book by David Wallace Wells who spells out really terrifying scenarios about what will happen if we don't, you know, seriously limit carbon emissions. And I think people are very interested in that book, judging by its place on the bestseller list.
Yeah, I think David's made a really valuable contribution there. And it's an honest book. But I think this whole conversation between, you know, hope or despair is itself a kind of sort of an entry-level engagement with the issue. And I think it's a particularly an American phenomenon. I don't think, you know, the Germans are maybe particularly optimistic or Scandinavians and, you know, some of these countries that are way ahead of us in terms of climate policy. I don't think they force-feed hope to their citizens to get them to care about the issue. And I feel like we're adults here and we should be able to talk about both the worst case scenarios and some, you know, optimistic, hopeful things that are going on and talk about the complexity of the issue and, you know, talk about not only our hopes for the future, but our failures to this point and our democracy's failures to this point. And there's no to reduce it down to hope versus fear itself seems to me kind of a form of dishonesty. And I think, you know, I'm all for activists figuring out the best way to motivate people to vote. But I think there's more to the story than that. And that's what I've tried to write about.
Do you think the hope versus despair motivational debate has to do with the fact that forward momentum has been blocked from so many directions, from the industry, from climate deniers, from, you know, politicians. And so the obstacles to moving forward are so great that something very motivational has to be done to counteract that through hope or despair.
Yeah, I think there's a huge amount of bitterness and frustration among people who care about this issue.
Because I just want to say to elaborate what I was saying, that the other countries you mentioned, they don't have climate deniers who are saying, hey, right, this isn't even a thing. This is just like fake science.
Yeah, and that's true. And I think what's interesting now about the way the conversation has turned in recent months, I mean, really since the midterms, is you have this major youth movement emerging. You see it in talk of the Green New Deal, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's, you know, speeches about it. You see it coming from the students in the Sunrise Movement when they sat in Nancy Pelosi's office after the election to demand climate action. You see it in these student walkouts. Greta Thunberg, a 16-year-old Swedish girl, has been leading and has become a global phenomenon. Those students, those people, those young people and the young leaders are no longer, you know, worried about, you know, engaging into this denialist thing. They're making a different kind of argument. They're saying that failure to act is harming us, is killing us, that you know, elders who are failing to act are stealing our future away from us. And that inaction at this point is not only stupid, which is what sort of activists have been saying forever, but is wrong, is morally wrong, and it undermines the very basis of our society. And I think that's a more powerful argument, and I frankly think politically that's a more powerful argument as well. I think it's also a more honest argument. They are appealing to a moral high ground, and I think that's enormously powerful.
And making it a life and death issue. Would you describe what you think the major takeaways are from the Green New Deal that was proposed by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ed Markey?
Yeah, well, it's a statement of principles primarily. It's not a law. It's not a bill. In some ways, it's in some of the particulars, it's less ambitious than bills that were proposed and introduced into Congress at the end of the 80s by both Republicans and Democrats. But I think what distinguishes it and what makes it a truly transformational document is that it identifies the climate crisis as connected to every form, essentially, of social injustice that we have. And I think that's the only honest way of looking at it. Climate change victimizes the victimized. It oppresses the oppressed. So the worse off you are, the more marginalized you are, the worse you're going to suffer from what's coming. And so it's extremely valuable in that it says that climate change is not just one item on the sort of menu of political items, but it's the one that encompasses them all, and that there's no such thing as you can't have social justice if there's not climate justice. You can't have a civil society, a stable society, if you don't have a stable climate. And I think that's a profound argument and an honest one. It puts it into moral terms in a way that is new in Washington. And I think that is enormously valuable. You can get into the debate about how best to achieve certain goals, and those are important policy debates to have, but it's reframed the issue dramatically and I think critically.
Okay, so you're 39. What are the things you're most concerned about seeing in terms of climate change in your lifetime and in your children's lifetime?
I think the most immediate way that we will feel this as members of one of the wealthiest countries in the world is the effect on geopolitical instability. When you have huge stresses on people, particularly in the developing world, who can no longer live the place they've been living, they have to leave.
Because of drought or floods.
So drought or flood. So I think the projections have it that there'll be enormous spikes in, migration all over the world. It's already started, of course, but it will only become more intense. And when you have huge masses of people moving from, one country to another, one region to another, it introduces enormous amounts of stress. And essentially what we're talking about is war. Is the ultimate outcome there. And so the fear then becomes of some kind of major global war that's sparked by stresses from climate change.
Nathaniel Rich, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Nathaniel Rich is the author of the new book, Losing Earth, A Recent History. After we take a short break, rock critic Ken Tucker will review the new album by the 17-year-old singer Billie Eilish. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org.
Hey, it's Guy here with a very exciting announcement. This coming October, we're going to be coming back to the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts in San Francisco for our second How I Built This Summit, supported by American Express. Over the course of 2 days, I'll have conversations with some of our most remarkable founders from the show, including David Neeleman of JetBlue, Marcia Kilgore of Bliss, Kevin Systrom and Mike Krieger of Instagram, Stuart Butterfield of Slack, Jen Rubio of Away, and many, many more. The summit is an incredible opportunity to connect with other entrepreneurs and builders just like you from around the world. Last year's summit sold out early, so to find out how to get tickets, visit summit.npr.org. And I hope to see you in San Francisco.
Billie Eilish is a 17-year-old singer-songwriter from California who's just released her debut album titled When We All Fall Asleep, Where Do We Go? She's already enormously popular on the strength of a series of singles she's released, most of them recorded at home, with her brother as her producer. Rock critic Ken Tucker says no one else in current music sounds like Billie Eilish. Here's his review.
Over a pulsing beat, the voice of Billie Eilish slides in. That voice is at once intimate, confiding, and slurry. It's hard to catch the words, but you get the gist. She's taunting a guy for being a bad guy, but then, mid-verse, she changes course, suggesting that she's the bad guy, that far from being a victim, she's a perpetrator. It's a clever, wily move, but then so much of what this 17-year-old singer-songwriter does is wily and clever. And her debut album, called When We All Fall Asleep, Where Do We Go?, is a frequently startling showcase for her sly smarts.
Baby, I don't feel so good. 6 words you never understood. I'll never let you go. 5 words you never say. I laugh alone like nothing's wrong. 4 days has never felt so long. If three's a crowd and two is us, one slipped away. I just wanna make you feel okay. But all you do is look the other way. I just kinda wish you were gay.
Billie Eilish was raised in Los Angeles, homeschooled by parents who are actors. Over the past couple of years, young Billie has racked up over 1 billion streams for her songs of quiet angst and self-mocking humor. Pretty good for a kid who's making most of her music at home, in her bedroom, with her brother. That brother is Phineas O'Connell, an actor and musician who writes some of her work and produces most of it. The song I just played, Wish You Were Gay, is one of the singles that established her popularity. In it, she talks about a stalled romance. Rather than confronting the reasons he might not have liked her, she says she just wishes he were gay, because if so, the pressure would be off her. That is primo teenage thinking, and kudos to Eilish for being honest enough to set it to music. Another song, Zanny, may warm the hearts of parents with its anti-drug message.
What is it about them? I must be missing something. They just keep doing nothing. Too intoxicated to be scared. Better off without them. They're nothing but unstable. Bring ashtrays to the table, and that's about the only thing they share. I'm in the secondhand smoke, still just drinking canned coke. I don't need a Zanny to feel better.
A song about being repulsed by her generation's rampant misuse of Xanax, Zanny tempts a listener to fixate on the lyrics, but the music should not be ignored. Eilish begins that song with a smoky sigh. It reminds me a little of Lana Del Rey, and even more of the Torch singer Julie London, to make a reference that might mean something to baby boomers, but will seem hopelessly obscure to Eilish and her Generation Z core audience. There's a premature world weariness about Eilish that she somehow makes enormously appealing. Her perennially poker-faced affect is a rebuke to any adult who might have the gall to tell her to lighten up. But her songs give her blank moodiness context, detail, and weight.
What do you want from me? Why don't you run from me? What are you wondering? What do you know? Why aren't you scared of me? Why do you care for me? When we all fall asleep, where do we go?
Come here.
Say it, spit it out. What is it exactly? Your pain is the amount cleaning you out. Am I satisfactory? Today I'm thinking about the things that are deadly. The way I'm drinking you down, like I wanna drown, like I wanna end more. Step on the glass.
That's Bury a Friend, whose screechy sound effects dramatize Eilish's lyric about a monster under the bed. She and her brother like to play around with her recorded voice, distorting it, making it blur into dance pop, whose beats owe something to hip-hop in their precise rhythms.
Don't ask questions, you don't wanna know. Learn my lesson, way too long ago. To be talking to you, Belladonna. Should've taken a break, not an Oxford comma. Take what I want when I wanna, and I want you. Bad, bad news.
Billie Eilish doesn't sound like anyone around right now, partly because her frame of reference seems so vast. In addition to hip-hop and electronic dance music, she seems to be on familiar terms with folk music, soul music, glam rock, heavy metal. It wouldn't have shocked me at all if this 17-year-old had concluded her album singing a duet with Willie Nelson. Instead, she wraps it up with three songs that are the most bleak and despairing ones on the album. I don't know where Eilish is heading, and I'll bet she finds my confusion just another measure of success.
Ken Tucker reviewed Billie Eilish's new album, When We All Fall Asleep, Where Do We Go? Tomorrow on Fresh Air, we'll talk about Congress in the Trump era. My guests will be Jake Sherman and Anna Palmer, who co-write Politico's newsletter, Playbook, and have written a new book called The Hill to Die On, The Battle for Congress and the Future of Trump's America. I hope you'll join us.
Standing there, killing time. Can't commit to anything but a crime. Leaders on vacation.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our associate producer of digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Hills burn in California. My turn to ignore ya. Don't say I didn't warn ya. The good girls go to hell, 'cause even God herself